Frank X. Walker is our next reader. He is a native of Danville, Kentucky, a graduate of the University of Kentucky, and he completed an MFA in writing at Spalding University in May 2003. He is author of three poetry collections, Black Box, Buffalo Dance, The Journey of York, which is winner of the 35th Annual Lillian Smith Award, and Afrolachia, a Kentucky Public Library's Choice Award winner. Frank?
This is where everybody is. I heard all that clap. I'm sitting behind the wall. I'm thinking, wow, four people clap awfully loud. Thank you for that. I think this is the second time we read together. This is kind of a ritual here in St. Louis. I'm going to figure out what I'm going to read while I'm standing here. Richard told me to shut up after 20 minutes. But I want to read from the sequel to Buffalo Dance. I think it was the last time I read Buffalo Dance. I felt compelled to, given the connection to St. Louis and the Lewis and Clark expedition. And many of you know the expedition, but you also acknowledge that one of the undertow parts of the story. Book out loud were questions about the absence of his wife. And after doing additional research, it turns out that he had two wives. There was a second wife that was Inez Pierce, maiden that he married while he was spent the winter in what is now Idaho. And I had a chance to, during the research, have dinner with descendants of York, who were also descendants of the Inez Pierce marriage that occurred. This information is not in any history book that was made available through the transcribed oral history. So I'm going to share some poems that talk about that relationship and his enslaved wife. So I think most of these voices I'm going to read will be in the voice of women, so you might have to close your eyes for them to work. But to open up the Lewis and Clark story, I want to read a voice that's actually the voice of the river in this book, and it's called The River Speaks. Call me the Ohio, the Mississippi, or the Missouri. Call me Wood, Teton, Yellowstone, Milk, Judith, Marias, Jefferson, Madison, Beaverhead, Bitterroot, Snake, Clearwater, or Palouse. Call me the wide-toothed mouth of the Columbia River. Call me after my many creeks, my great falls, my hot springs. I am the snow atop Mount Adams. I am the salty hope in the air at Cape Disappointment. I am she who is the deep and the shallows, a thundering waterfall and a quiet storm. I am always present in the air, on every tongue, in every drop of milk and blood and tear. You will find me in every thorn and flower, seed and fruit. There is no life without me. I am libation and baptismal pool. I am your sprinkle of holy water. I am older than man and light. I am of God, not God. But like God, I am also inside of every man, for all are born in me and formed there until they are flushed naked into the world. And I remain there in them like God until they depart and return to dust. Captain Clark saw me as a great wet road that could be conquered with the rowing and paddling of men under his command. So I showed him my many rapids and waterfalls, made his men carry their own boats and supplies around me for miles at a time. These were the good years White men had not yet studied the beaver and learned how to redirect my paths, manage my flow, harness it for their own use, attempt to enslave me too. Captain Lewis was different. To him, I was a piece of art. He marveled at the natural folly of my water locks and felt humbled by the beautifully carved rock masterpieces that adorned my canyons and walls. While I have at most been an open way for the white man, to the red man, I have been viewed as a helpmate, considered a wife, carrying their salmon and trout, providing for their transportation and nourishment, surrounding them, moving through them in the heat of the sweat lodge, answering their prayers when they dance. But the black one was the only one taught to both fear and respect me. And though I was the road that carried the ships of death to and from Africa's shores, I became the waiting, outstretched arms for those who refused to be enslaved, for those who trusted me to rock their babies off to sleep. My ocean floors are covered with his people's resistance. I carry their spirit in every splash I make. Their humming, their lost voices, their last words have become a part of my sweetest songs. When he is whole again, when York knows what he is worth, I will well up inside of him, and he will hear them sing. Now that voice opens up the second collection, and it tries to pull the landscape in as a major character. I think that you can't really experience the Lewis and Clark expedition and not appreciate, you know, how significant the landscape is in that experience. I'm going to skip straight to the voice of his Nez Perce wife, and I'll read maybe two or three from there, and you may figure out why this book is already banned in middle schools. Art of Seduction. I know a hungry man's eye can undress a woman from across a smoldering fire because York did it. When I grew warm to his advances, I gave him permission and invited him over without ever opening my mouth. I looked away, then back, then away, then back so slow. My eyes returned to meet his, and it made his nostrils flare, and my heart beat like two drums in my chest. He didn't have a courting flute, so the first music we made between us was a way of looking into each other's eyes and exchanging naked promises so full of heat. Passersby would swear we were already man and wife. His hands were big and rough from a life full of hard work. But when they were filled with me, each one became a party of men deep in the wilderness, intent on exploring every mound and knowing all of the hollowed out and sacred places. Lover's Moon. After the red-headed one's bed is made and his stomach full of meat, he gives my York the slice of daylight left to do as he pleases. Pretending not to rush back to me, he passes by and nods. After I track him down in the dark, jump on his back and wrestle him to the ground, we wander off laughing toward the horses and follow the riverbank upstream, holding hands and looking for a private place to celebrate the way the moon dances on the face of the water. We find a rock to hold all our clothes and play in the shallows like children. But after our bodies kiss, we stop to weigh the gift of time alone and grow up real fast. Midnight Ride. After the fires die down, a moon full of shine allows us to wander off into the night's arms. Urged on by the river and the night's music, our two quickly become one. Straddled aboard him, a buffalo robe around my shoulders and nothing else, I close my eyes and ride low and close, the way a hunter tracks buffalo in the deep winter snow. Our gentle trot becomes a gallop, and after a good sweat, our gallop becomes a quiet stand. Then we bow our heads and wait for our breaths to catch up. After a quick dip in the cold river, I mount back up for warmth, and we ride slow and long until my legs quiver and York finds the strength to harness himself. When he carries me back home to our mat, folded up in his arms like a child, we lie down in the lap of the night, both empty and full and sleep. And I'm going to skip to the middle part to give York a chance to say something so you can hear his voice again. But those last three poems were from a suite of poems that are all in the voice of the Nez Perce wife, and it tries to give you a narrative for their full evolution of their relationship. But this is York still wrestling with the thing that I think he wrestled with the most, was this idea of the relationship between power and literacy. Primer 2. I can read the heart of a woman in her eyes as easy as a lie in a man's face. The direction and power of a storm speaks clearly to me from low-flying bird wings. I can dip my fingers into muddy hoof or toe print and tell how many of what I'm going to have for dinner. The thickness of tree bark, walnut hulls, and tobacco worms tell me how ugly winter gonna be. I knows the seasons like a book. I can read moss, sunsets, the moon, and a mare's foaling time with a touch. Would I trade all this to know how to scratch out my name as more than an X? To have my stories leap off paper as easy as they roll off my tongue? To listen to my own eyes make the words on parchment say, this here man be York. He can come and go as he please, work for himself, own land, learn his books, live and die free. What do you think? And I'll close this part with his enslaved wife's voice. And it opens, her series of love poems open with a response to the question that a lot of people ask me, what was her name? And the history books have yet to reveal what her name was. The fact of the matter is that after they returned from the expedition, the family that owned his wife moved out of Kentucky. So he had a brief time and a chance to visit, and she kind of disappeared from history so far. So the first poem is called Say My Name. And this is the enslaved wife's voice. Folks round here want to call me Auntie, York's old wife, or Massa So-and-so's nigger wench, like I ain't got a name of my own. Dem don't know how hard it be to put aside a little piece of myself that nobody can't never touch but me. A piece big enough to wrestle the long, hard days and keep itself warm at night without a man around. Them don't know what it like to stand in the dark night after night wrapped in that buffalo robe he sent. Look up at the stars and wonder which ones is looking down on him. And believe if something bad happened to him out there that I would feel it too. When he comes home, I don't need him to say he loved me. I don't need him to bring me gifts. I just want him to hold me close, make like he glad to see me, bend down to my ear and whisper my name. I also believe that if they truly loved each other, that as soon as he walked in the cabin, that she could look him in the eye and know immediately he'd been with another woman. So this next poem introduces that idea. It's called Unwelcome Guest. I don't think York knowed I could see her too. The first time was in the corner of his eye while he looked far off but stare at the plate right in front of him. He didn't say nothing about her, but the way his lips turned up at the ends said plenty. Now, I ain't one to sass. His growl helped me to know a slave woman's place. So I sits up all night with both my hands and ears open, waiting to catch her name on his lips. After that, no matter how much he talk of grizzlies, buffaloes, big fish, mountains, or oceans, she become all I can see, all I want to know. It gets so crowded in our little place, I swears I can almost smell her. And by then, I knows one of us will have to go. Now, she can't take him to divorce court, obviously. But she is not without means. So she's going to reach for a folk remedy. This is called the sunflower seed oil conjure. First, I get some fresh well water and puts it on to boil. Stirs up a tea brewed from apricot vine, rattlesnake weed, and plenty of honey. Then I sets him down between my knees and with a wooden tooth comb left to me by my mama's mama, commenced the scratching at his scalp till his shoulders look covered with snow. Then I fills up my wash tub with boiling water doctored with peppermint root and sets to scrubbing him slow enough for the heat to open his doors. When his body is clean, I starts back to work on his head, busting up a mean suds and using my fingers to walk up and down his scalp till he let loose a low moan and his eyes start to roll around in his head. After I rinses all the force out, I starts back in with warm sunflower seed oil, only this time every finger make its own little circle while both my hands make bigger ones, and they follows each other from the stiff tree limbs in the back of his neck across his crown to his soft spot, while my thumbs dig in slow and deep where the headaches come on. I pours the extra oil into my hands and rub his neck and shoulders down to his ribs and arms, then like a turtle dance, I moves back up again. I work slow and hard, and after a while, when I gets all the way to his man sack, he open his eyes and be glad it's me. See, those of you who are married, you recognize the power of that last poem. I want to close with two more from this series. And it's York's voice followed by his enslaved wife's voice. And it also, these are the two poems that give the collection its title. And they're trying to, in my estimation, kind of sum up the challenge of maintaining a healthy, psychologically and emotionally healthy relationship inside the institution of slavery, if that's even possible. This is York. To have and to hold. It do more harm than good to be enslaved and agree to love forever. When there be folks over us with even more power than death to do us part, being another man's property, all I can promise is when we in the same quarters, no one will hold you closer or with more tenderness than me. If ever I have to choose between another day of service and death, I will always choose living. Even if Massa sell me down the Mississippi tomorrow or pair me up with another woman to breed, I will only think on what we had and chase away any thoughts of what we had not. I aims to see you every Sunday and Christmas, but if ever I'm away more than two whole seasons without sending back word, untie the ribbons from that broom we jump, mourn for me but a little, then set your mind to figuring on how you gonna stay warm when winter comes. And this is her response. Real cost. Somewhere out there, Somewhere out there, he learned to touch me like I'm a woman, and not just some woman, me. In our marriage bed, he seemed as interested in pleasing me as he be in spilling himself. I knew he'd come back changed when new words fall out his mouth like love and freedom and manhood. And there come a look in his eye like he owned all three, free and clear, and don't need no papers to prove it. But it scared me because I seen that look in many a black eye before white hammers nailed it shut or left it frozen open and swinging to teach the rest what anything that smelled like courage cost. I have no doubt he give his life to stay with me. So I don't tell him that Massa taking me back down south. I just kiss him soft to sleep and stare at him long enough to call up his face when I gets old and thankful he still be breathing somewhere when winter comes. Thank you. I'm going to skip ahead about 200 years and read some poems, some new poems that are that try to take on the challenges of another relationship, another set of husband and wives. Right now, I'm using these poems to kind of interrogate history. These are all what I'm calling the Mega Ever series, and the voices are Byron Day LeBeckwith, the assassin, Thelma, his wife, and Merle Evers, the widow. And these are not happy poems, but this is where they are. And I just want to share those because I think at the heart of them, they take on the challenge of you know, how do people stay married no matter what the conditions are, what the challenges are. I'll read first from the assassin's voice. Byron Day LeBeckwith, you know, trying to figure out the starting point for how he became a unrepentant, violent racist. Rotten fruit. This is Byron speaking. Three parts. One, I fish for pleasure and to relax. It's the best way to sort out details of a plan that needs flawless execution. Every useful thing I know, I learned sitting in the bottom of a boat across from my daddy in one of Mississippi's finest fishing holes. How to pick out the best spot. How to get there early. How to lay low, be patient, and wait. Two, watching your cork disappear in the water, bob back up and run is as thrilling as sneaking your hand up under a pretty girl's skirt. They all put up a little fight at first, but sooner or later, a lucky man will get his hands on a cat, a patient man inside a big wide mouth. There's something about the thought of a wet body flapping about and gasping for breath that gives me chills even now. Three. Sometimes we just sit and smoke, swim in some ice-cold beers, enjoy the sound of no women around, or shoot at ghosts if fish weren't biting. Sometimes we get drunk and argue for hours about who would win in a fair fight between his nigger Jack and that nigger Joe Lewis. He rode me hard for bragging about catching the big one, but I know he bragged about teaching me how to fish. Anatomy of Hate. This is still Byron Day LeBeckwith. I got no problem with colored who know their place, but it's easy to hate troublemakers and integrationists, uppity monkeys in suits and ties, little more than pet dogs for northern scum, pissing on our proud heritage. Yeah, I shot that boy in the back, but not 'cause I hated his color. I hated how clean he kept his car. I hated his always pressed clothes and shiny shoes. I hated that he parked in front of his own house. I hated the sound of the north and schools and books every time he opened his nigger lips. The prosecution said he was only speaking on equality and freedom. But what I heard when he flapped his black gums was poor white trash, lick our union boots, and watch us do to your wives and daughters what the slavers done to ours. I said these weren't happy poems. I'm going to skip Beckwith and go to his wife, Thelma. This is called Fireproof. And I really, the question I ask myself is, how does, they stay married to the end of his life. The only marriage they had. How does a woman love a man like that, that a lot of people think is a monster? But surely had to be something good about him, or it said something about her. This is called Fireproof. He would come home from Klan rallies and council meetings, so in love with me, I could never see nothing wrong with what he did with his hands. I just pretended I didn't know what gunpowder smelled like, or why he kept his guns so clean. If he walked to the door and said, "Thelma, burn these clothes," I'd pile them on the coals and stare at the fire. I'd listen to the music twixt the crackle and calm. And while the ashes gathered round their own kind in the bottom of the grate, I'd watch the embers glow like our bedroom did. Now, I ain't saying he was right or wrong. He often confused hatred with desire. But if you ain't never been licked by flames in the middle of the night, honey, you got no idea what I'm talking about. This is her again, white, right, and Christian. And this is her speaking directly to Merle Evers, the widow. And Merle will answer back. "You are wrong to think my man a monster, a lowly coward because he grins at you from across the courtroom. Your shallow faith won't let you see his generosity or his compassion. Don't you see the courtesy he extended to you by opening up a hole in that boy's black back and not his face, allowing you and your children the dignity of an open casket, a vision of perfect sleep instead of a bloody stump where his head rests now?" And this is Merle's response. It's called Sorority Meeting. "My faith urges me to love you. My stomach begs me to not. All I know is that day made us sisters somehow. After long, nervous nights and trials on end, we are bound together in this unholy sorority of misery. I think about you every time I run my hands across the echoes in the hollows of my sheets. They seem loudest just before I wake. I open my eyes every morning, half expecting Megger to be there. Then I think about you, and your eyes always snatch me back. Your eyes won't let me forget. We are sorority sisters now, with a gut-wrenching country ballad for a sweetheart song, tired funeral and courtroom clothes for colors, and secrets that we will take to our graves. I was forced to sleep night after night after night with a ghost. You chose to sleep with a killer. We both pledged our love, crossed our hearts, and swallowed oaths before being initiated with a bullet. Thank you." I'll close with two family poems that are a lot warmer and that hopefully touch you in a different part of your gut. For those of you who may know a little bit about my work, you know that I write a lot about not just my father, but our effort over the last almost 40 years to build a relationship. And it started very late because my parents divorced when I was about 4, and I didn't really see my father until I was about to go to college. And at that point, outside of my mother's jurisdiction, I made the decision to try to build something with my father. So there's a series of poems in every book I put out that kind of captures where that relationship is. Last summer, we reached a new milestone. And it was in an interesting situation. I think we were both extra vulnerable. It was at his brother's funeral. And I found my father in the parking lot at the funeral home, you know, chain smoking cigarettes, but he was walking around. And he was seemed a little nervous, but when I saw him, I noticed that his tie was horribly tied. And it was, first of all, it was a big white tie with a huge knot bigger than my fist, and the front side was shorter than the back side. And everybody who knows about ties know that's a no-no. So when I found him, I found myself taking the tie loose and retying it. And then in that moment, I realized that we don't touch each other. We're not that close yet. And it was uncomfortable space for both of us. So it is what it is. It's called Burying Albatross. In the parking lot behind the funeral home, my eyes settle on the bulky white noose my father has lost a wrestling match to. Though he is not convinced Windsor not know-how can plant tobacco or drive a nail true, he concedes his flawed results, abides my desire to fix it. Calling up knowledge passed to me from a book, I execute the maneuvers with fluid precision and imagine I'm creasing and folding a Japanese paper swan. He stares at my knuckles, smiling, perhaps seeing his own hands stuck on a high ceiling or replacing a worn-out alternator. Standing close enough to kiss, we almost touch and pretend to bury other heavy things sewn together like the opposite ends of the fabric in my hands. Before I let him go, all the sage advice and words of encouragement that never breathed air between us spreads a silent wing and slides through a perfect slip knot home.